because starting from here, he starts talking about diction, which is word choice, and everything that Ibsen was talking about, because his thesis is that Ibsen has a very narrow view of poetry. He's really only talking about word choice or diction, and he's leaving out those other six elements that Aristotle said make up a poem. Now, what are those six elements? You remember?
Reversal.
Those are types of plot.
Yes. Whole plot's one.
Remember plot, character, thought, diction, spectacle, music, spectacle. Okay? Characters, and they're all related. Right? Whatever the sequence of things that characters do is the plot. Okay? Although Olson has this horrible habit of calling that the action, like the whole plot is an action, it's one of the reasons he's not, that this was not that well accepted, because he doesn't explain that action thing properly. He gets lost in the funhouse of what is plot. Okay, everybody gets lost there, but there's a simple solution. Same problem Lewis had when he's talking about myth. He's really talking about that overall plot. And for Lewis, there was really only one myth. It was you descend to hell and you come back up. Okay, the plant dies, it grows again. God is crucified, goes down to hell, comes up, rises. So for him, the Christian myth is just the ultimate expression of the easiest myth, the Orpheus myth. You go down to hell, something bad happens. Okay, you come back up and you get released. All right. That's, I guess that would be an action. But the character had to do something. He had to at least walk into the cave, and right? And before he walked into the cave, he had to think about it. So thought is the next thing, right? Should I put my left foot in front of the right one? Okay. No, I won't. Yes, I will. All right. And in this story, for example, if you ask, what did old Lou do? What did he really do here? In the story. That's why I like to look at it. What did he actually do in the story, as opposed to what he sort of had planned the day before and sort of went? I mean, he goes to visit all these people, but he seems to do that every day, or he thought about it before. He fought the wind. He went to see the city guy. He didn't really think about that. He just sort of goes. So I wouldn't call it an action. So he didn't weigh the consequences. Should I go out? Should I not go out? He went. He was already in motion when the story starts. But where in the story does he actually do something? It's actually a not do in this case. Really, he sits there, he thinks about it. There's a series of not do's, but the big one is in Thing, what's his name's house, right? When he doesn't speak about the girl. That's his big action. That was the thing he weighed out, right? That was his moral choice. That was his moment, okay? You see, that showed his character, and you did a wonderful analysis of his character. But in terms of the plot, that was it. Man goes to the house of a prospective bride for either himself or his son and says nothing. Right? Where he was supposed to say something. Right? So that's a huge moment. So that's kind of the plot. And it's obviously a repeating plot, but the point of the short story is we only see it once. If this was a romance, he would do it, many times. And we see versions of it in the, when he fights the wind and doesn't. Anyway, so that's an action based on his thought. So that's the first three elements. Now, how do we know what he's thinking? Well, in a drama, the character has to speak. We know from his words. And in the story, it's the same thing. Either the narrator tells us, okay, or the speaker says it. In this case, we blur them both, which is very nice, because it's more powerful than if the narrator says it, because that doesn't look like thought. It looks like, you know, the narrator can tell us what's in somebody's head, but it's the narrator's diction. Okay, here is the character's diction, with all his hesitations and his little expressions, which you were talking about. Skim the cream off the, what is it, the milk or something, right? And we assume that tells us about his character, especially because he uses the phrase twice. And so it means he's implying it, right? Now, where's the music? How does the music get in there?
Sounds, just sounds.
Yeah, the sound of the language, okay? And the rhythm of the language, and the length of those sentences, just what you were talking about.
Someone was talking about how the Chinese sounds more romantic.
Yeah. So the sound, if it's poetic, you know, you can see the meter. Right. Well, spectacle doesn't kick in, really, I don't think. Maybe the beautiful calligraphy on the page, I don't know. The printed book. It's not like a movie or a drama, all right, where you have acting.
It's like setting. And
those are what make up a poem in Aristotle's sense of the poetics. And that's what Olson is arguing that Ibsen doesn't think about, that he's only thinking about diction. Okay. So on page 146, having made that case, it's time for him to go into a narrow focus on diction and not only show that Ibsen didn't think about the other five parts of a poem. He didn't do a good job on diction. All right. So the diction part is from 146 to the end. The problem is he falls into the problem of the Chicago school. All right. And the New Criticism had lots of critical approaches too. All right. And the best review, when I was in grad school, we did all these things, and there was a book by a guy named Frederick Cruz, who's actually a writing instructor at Berkeley. It's called The Poo Perplex. It's 12 essays, 12 different critical approaches, analyzing Winnie the Pooh. It was a story for children about a little child named Christopher Robin and his teddy bear. But he gets fantasized and the teddy bear comes to life and is Winnie the Pooh, right? So, you ever heard of it? Vaguely, all right. So we get the 12 essays on Winnie the Pooh. Now, this is written came out in 1970. So it's, you know, it doesn't have post-structuralism, but it's hilarious. It's really funny. And there's one essay on the Chicago school. And the joke of the problem with the Chicago school, like Olson, and the punchline in the essay is, well, we can look at Pooh and his relationship to the honey pot, of course, in 12 ways. Let me list these 12 rubrics, and that's what Olson keeps doing here, okay? Like on page 147, in the middle full paragraph, this second sentence. The mimetic poet, like any other, may be said to have 7 subsidiary aims. That's like, why 7? I mean, he never tells us why 7. He just lists the 7 and then explains them. And it's all pretty good. But and then there's like, there's the 5 ways to achieve clarity on page 149. And you know, you can. He keeps doing that, and then there's the. He sort of wanders away at the end on the. Let's see. The 3 aspects of the metaphor on page 155. I'll just take that one since there's only 3. It's easy. Which is actually a very good discussion of metaphor, right? And shows, and we use these terms all the time, and you need to know them, but people don't talk about them in psychoanalytic terms or anything like that. But metaphor is the very essence of poetry, right? And Aristotle said you can't be a poet unless you can make a metaphor. That's the whole thing. And the traditional analysis of metaphor in English poetry was done by a guy named I.A. Richards in 1929. A big book came out, and I forget the title, but I.A. Richards was an English educator at Cambridge, and they realized that no one in the schools in England could read poetry and have any idea what it was about. So they tried to develop lessons. And his work led to the new criticism. And again, he was the sort of father of Ibsen and his ambiguity. Well, you didn't try and teach history. That was too difficult. You didn't try and teach the life of the author because they were all drunks anyway, right? But you could look at a short poem and talk about the language. Right? And even if you couldn't figure out what the poem was about, you could find metaphors in it fairly easily and talk about those and pass the course. Okay? And I. Richard said there's two aspects to the metaphor, the tenor and the vehicle. Those are the terms he used. The tenor is the thing you're talking about, my life. The vehicle is the image you choose to represent it.
A rocket ship.
My life is a rocket ship. All right. A potato chip. Right? And you know, I get it. It's because it crumbles. Or because it takes off. Right? What Olson adds here is another term, which is kind of interesting. He adds the continuum, okay? That the metaphor depends on, the actual working of it depends on how extensively the two things interrelate. Okay? You know, I could say my life is a rocket ship because it takes off. And you could say, oh, does that mean it has liquid hydrogen propulsion? I go, no, you're going a little too far. I wasn't implying that at all. Okay? Right? So the continuum is fairly narrow. But some metaphors are very big. I could say, yes, it is liquid hydrogen. And I've got some right here. Do you want some? Drug fueled, right? So you get to, so it's a nice little point that he ends on, and he manages to define symbolism by the bottom of the page, which this is just sort of leaped out at me, because symbolism is a term we use all the time. Everybody uses the term symbol, and you know, and then in the old days you get hung up: is it a Freudian symbol or is it a who is the other German psychologist? The archetype guy who did
Jung.
Yeah, Jung. Is it a Jungian symbol? You know, that's the kind of thing they talked about in the 30s, and today would be a Lacanian symbol. So, you know, it's just updated psychology. It's still bringing theories of psychology into the literature classroom. I mean, I got a whole new one for you if you want one. Like I was when I did my presentation on the first lines for the liberal arts senate, I was preceded by a young lady who teaches at communications, right? And she was doing diversity and communications it was a course for pre-majors. That you had they have so many communications majors. They sort of weed you through this course to see if you're still interested, and whether they'll let you have a camera and a microphone. Eventually, you have to pass this course. And she was putting a diversity element into it. But the course was, this is for sophomores, 23 theories of interpersonal communication. Interpersonal communication, intergroup. Don't even ask me what they are, all right? But you can see some guy writes a theory of communications. Oh, you know, an easy one, men talking to women, women to men, older to younger, large group to small group. Remember, groups are everything, right? And here it was, I'm going, and she got asked, what do the students think? She goes, well, I don't know because I don't run the discussion section. She just gets the lecture there in those classes, and then the graduate students actually meet the students, right? Sounds deadly boring. But nobody listens to me. Deadly boring, right? 23. But I tell you, with those 23 types of interpersonal communication, you just pick out the latest ones. You could put them in any novel, any play. I'm sure it works fine. Okay, you would, Professor X at the University of Y said this, and look, if we read Dickens, we see this is true. Okay, it gets the mind loose anyway, right?
The question I always say with that kind of stuff is, to what extent is the theory enhancing the literature, or the literature enhancing
the
theory?
Well, it definitely brings stuff out that you wouldn't see before. I mean, we didn't think about women or missing mothers in Shakespeare, but it's clearly there until we had gender feminist criticism. So, I mean, it's clearly there.
Right, oh yeah.
Right? And I think you need to be somewhat cognizant of it. Anyway, so here's the symbol. Which is what I was talking about. When both referent and continuum are suppressed or only vaguely intimated, the metaphor becomes a symbol. In other words, when I drop the part about my life and I just have the rocket ship and I don't tell you to what extent that rocket ship actually represents my life, I leave it to you to decide whether it's the hydrogen. And that becomes a symbol. So I just have a big rocket. Right. That was pretty interesting way to think about it. Okay, the problem, like on page 156, it's like he ran out of gas and it just sort of drifts off. And then the last paragraph, the study of diction, even as tropes and figures, may scarcely be regarded as completed. More research for graduate students writing their dissertations on types of metaphor. And you can see, I think I'd rather do the feminist criticism than that stuff, right? But it's still a way to think. These are terms we use, and they're terms particularly appropriate to the literary art. So if you think in these terms and you put it underneath your theoretical analysis, you'll do pretty well, right? But I think you have to have this kind of formal stuff. So let me think. I know you're getting... You've been here a while. Let's just go through this really quickly. First he looks at Ibsen's ambiguity and he attacks it. So let's just take one example on, and I think it's pretty effective. I mean, Ibsen was a bit of a nut, and that book never did much for me, but boy, there's people swear by it. I mean, you just can't get away from it. People really believe that if, you know, the point of a poem is that you can't understand what it says. And the big moment in my life came when a professor said, I said, you know, here's Kubla Khan by Coleridge, and it's all meaningless, isn't it? But you can feel the mood. It's this romantic chasm or whatever, you know, Xanadu de Kubla Khan, a stately pleasure dome decree where Alph, the sacred river, ran through caverns measureless to man, down to a sunless sea. It's wonderful stuff. And he says, so what's the pleasure dome look like? I go, I thought that was a great question, you know? Right?
What?
And the funny thing, we had a professor here, you'll probably figure out who I'm talking about. When he did his job talk, he went up to the board and he said, and he was talking about Kubla Khan. Here, he said, here's the stately pleasure dome, you know, it's like the super dome.
Mm-hmm.
No. I mean, the dome in that case is from domus. It's a house, it's not a dome. It's his palace. They have a moat around it, but it is not the Superdome. But he didn't have a classical education, which Coleridge did. Right. So, anyway, it still is a good question. What's it look like? Well, let's just take this one example here on page 123. The quotation. This is from Macbeth. When Macbeth is trying to decide whether to kill King Duncan, if it were done, when 'tis done, then 'twere well, it were done quickly. In other words, if I could murder him and go to bed, you know, get it over with, I'd be happy, but you know, it's the blood and it drags out and everything, you know, makes for a long night. Okay. Well, the question is here, Ibsen says it's a double syntax, so you can't know what this means. Because you could stop the sentence after the word well. If it were done, when 'tis done, then 'twere well. See, because you're moving linearly as you read. This is exactly the way Stanley Fish does criticism, and he made big money on this. Big money, but it just always struck me as insane. And that's what Olson is saying here. You can't stop it well because there's no period.
Right.
And it leaves the fragment in the next line unexplained. You have to go around the corner. That's just the nature of the beast. Fish's example was the last line of Milton's Lycidas, where the shepherd at the end of the poem, "At last he rose and twitched his mouth of blue, tomorrow to fresh woods and pastures new." At last he rose and twitched his mouth of blue, tomorrow to fresh woods and pastures new. And then Stanley Fish says, well, if you're reading linearly, like all reading is, you could stop. You know, you have an ambiguity because you could stop at the end of the first line. At last he rose and twitched. It's not there. Okay? But most people think it is.
You're only looking at diction.
And you can't prove it. I mean, and I may be wrong. And maybe the other people may be right. Who knows? But
at Newbery, yeah. Everybody is bad mouthed
the fish. Yeah, but someone like Spencer, they go nuts on this stuff. They want. Everything's got to be double meaning. But I think he really makes a strong case that if you understand the dramatic situation, the whole picture, what's going on with the character in the plot, you would never say he rose and twitched. He's not neurotic. He does not have a spastic tic. It's nighttime and he's putting his coat on. Okay, that's all there is to it. Right. So we get the attack. This is actually good for deconstruction at the bottom of 124, which again is a good way to think about stuff, but you just have to be careful with it when you're picking your trope. And I'm looking at the line about 7 lines up from the bottom. The problem with tropes is, why is it used? Not just figuring it out, but why is it in there? Right. Really, it's too late to be going into examples. Let's see if I can do this really quickly. He's got the types of communication on page 126 to 127. Okay, what is meaning? I mean, this is always a big topic. What does a poem mean? And there was a book that came out called "How Does a Poem Mean?" And I don't think meaning is really the key. It's really what happens and who's the character? Can you describe the people the way Song did today? I thought pretty well. So there's verbal meaning with without inference, nonverbal communication, 4 things. All right, look at that. 128, that'll probably be a good place to stop. All right. That short little paragraph. Presumably, however, Ibsen means the diction of the poem when he speaks of poetry. In that case, he confuses the diction with the poem. And what in the back of his mind is the Aristotelian notion that there are 6 parts to a poem, and this leaves out plot, action, character, and spectacle, and rhythm or music. Okay. So once you get that in mind, I think you can follow him a lot more easily. Okay. Again, on page 130, at the top, if you keep in mind that what's in the back of his mind is that a poem is more than the diction; it's the whole construct. Okay. Then there's one last little trick these Chicago guys like to do. That's on page 134. Okay. The last paragraph, he says, "A very little discussion will, I hope, make this clear. All poetic theory is a form of causal explanation. And such an explanation must comprise all the causes requisite to make a thing what it is." When he says causes, that's a loaded word for him. He's thinking of Aristotle's 4 causes. The 4 causes of a poem or anything. Right? And it doesn't bring this out. And this is a good way of thinking, but it's a terrible way to write. So you don't want to write your dissertation on the 4 causes, but you want to think about them. And when somebody does, it's boring. Okay, but see if I can remember them. anything can be explained in terms of the four causes. The formal cause, material cause, efficient cause, and final cause. So let's take a house or a poem. Okay. Well, in the case of a house, what are the materials? Wood, steel, nails. In the case of a poem, what are the materials?
Words,
right? So the materials, in the diction, is a material. So when he starts using the word material, he means the words that make up the diction. Right? Different languages have different word groups that they can use, so they're kind of going to be limited, in a sense, to their effects. Right? What's the formal cause? This is the genre theory part. All right. Well, in the house, is the, you know, I want a pointed roof so the snow slides off, and I want some windows, and that's what it's going to look like. Okay. And in a play, I want five acts so I can have the rising action and the counterstroke and the denouement. All right. Or I want a, you know, a plot where the guy leaves home and comes back. Right. And that's the form. The poem. And there's plenty of thinking to be done in that form, but there's no simple answer. All right. What's the efficient cause? The efficient cause is the maker of the thing. This is cause in the sense we don't use the word cause today. The carpenter or the builder of the house is the efficient cause. He's the one who put it together. There would be, you could have materials, you can have a form, but unless somebody puts it together, right, you have nothing. And the poet is the efficient cause of the poem. So it becomes very important. Even, right, you really do want to know who the person is who's doing it, right? Because a lot, you know, might turn on that. The final cause is the purpose for which you do it. This is also a very tough one, and I haven't thought this through, but Aristotle says basically, well, the house is to live in, but the poem is to produce pleasure as a poem. That's why he distinguishes mimetic poems. You know, we imitate things because it pleases you. You want to see my dance, you know? Okay. Not because you're going to learn anything, but because it pleases you to watch the imitation. You want to see my Iago? You, Othello, I hate you. How was that? Okay? Yeah, right. So it gives you the pleasure. Plus, this pleasure gets, and where he leaves out here is this pleasure consists of lots of different emotions. Okay? Sets of emotional ranges. And that will help, that may be related to genre, but he doesn't get into it here. We maybe have to think about it later. The obvious ones are pity and fear for a tragedy, or laughter in a comedy, stuff like that. The pleasure is peculiar to the text. Here's a poem that makes me weep, and therefore I enjoy weeping. I have the pleasure of the sadness. I go to a horror movie because I like to be scared. Right? So they're all different effects, seem to have some relation to genre, but he's not talking about it here. Right? So those are the four causes. And while we're in this, okay, there was a theorist who's the god of the Red Comp people, called Kenneth Burke. That's all they talk about. Who was a failed literary critic. Because he wrote these essays nobody could understand. But he was actually the guy who coined the phrase the Chicago Aristotelians. He hung out with Elder Olson. He would come in to visit, but he was a real independent spirit. But he couldn't, like, I'm not sure he was an independent spirit or he couldn't keep a job. But he was here, I met him, he was a very clever guy, no doubt about it. Witty, he'd just talk your ear off. He would go all night. Okay? I mean, just go all night. So, very, very smart and very independent. He said, well, there's actually a fifth cause, right? And he, and that's why the notion of Burke's pentad comes from. Okay, where does all this stuff occur? Okay, where is the poem? Where is the house? Where is the poem? So he puts in, you know, basically it's the scene. Okay, which covers the whole notion. Maybe it's related to that continuum thing, but that's, you know, the scene of, yeah, right. Yeah, these things are good. You know, it's what's behind all this thing. How useful they are, I don't know, like the end of the essay, you just tail off. You start getting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different types of trope or poem or pleasures, and there's no end to it. And Olson wrote a book on comedy that sort of showed this. Tragedy, all tragedies are basically the same. They produce pity and fear. Comedies are all different. There is no end to the variety of forms that go up to make comedy. So a formalist has got a problem that he can't create, you know, a structure of comedy. So the Chicago thing doesn't have life. You almost have to go into these theories. You almost have to go outside of poetry itself. So he'll talk about what's poetry. What does poetry do that the other arts don't do? Okay, you can go to the psychology department all day, and they're not going to be talking about the four causes of a poem and the six parts, you know, the relationship between plot and character and thought. And you can go to the, you know, the sociologists, and this stuff is the. And that's why they liked Aristotle. It's the, you know, it may not be much what poetry does, but there's a little nugget that it's got all to itself. Even the diction is shared with rhetoric. Okay, so that's this. That's your overview. 5 minutes over. Sorry.